All right. Hi, I'm Jill, I'm an alcoholic.
How are you?
My sobriety date is May 10th of 2010. I have a sponsor and I have a home group, and thank you so much for asking me to come out tonight and share my story. This is a really wonderful and special meeting, and it's really an honor to be able to participate in this with you guys, so I really appreciate it. I'm really nervous, so I'm just kind of waiting. I'm hoping like by like 10 minutes in, I won't be thinking about it anymore. And I don't know why I get nervous. I mean, I know the story. It's all in my head. But my sponsee told me that if I get too nervous, I can just start talking about her. So maybe I'll do that. All right. Well, I'll just tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I always kind of like to talk about at the beginning what I felt like as a kid, just because you know, I've heard people talk about it in meetings, and I really related. I wouldn't have had the word to tell you this, but I was a really self-centered kid. I just thought I was like really sensitive, and just wanted to like be liked and all that stuff. But really, what it was is I just thought about myself all the time. You know, it's like, what do you think about me? Do my parents still love me? Like, what do people think about me in school? Like, what's your favorite color? Because I want it to be my favorite color, so you like me. And I was just always in my head. And I hear a lot of people talk about not getting the playbook for life. You know, that like at birth, you know, there was like a pamphlet they got handed out, and this is how you should act, this is how you should dress, this is how you should play, all this stuff. And I like didn't get it, so I was like constantly trying to play catch up with everyone around me. And I was just like super insecure. Like I wouldn't, you know, like little kids have like lunch boxes, you know, with their favorite cartoon character or superhero or whatever. And I would carry a brown paper bag because it's like, God forbid, like I carried, you know, my Little Pony, lunchbox, and like everybody would make fun of me and that would be terrible and I'd have to go home and switch schools and like life would be over. So I carried a brown paper bag. My room was decorated in all black because like it was a very safe color, and I really didn't like know who I was or what I liked because I was too insecure to tell you or figure it out on my own. You know, I was just always trying to fit in. So that's sort of what we were dealing with. I grew up in a house where there was a lot of drinking. I'm an only child. I never wanted for anything. I had two parents that loved me more than life itself and gave me everything that they possibly could. I had a pony and I had a pool and there were birthday parties and there were toys and there were trips and it was just wonderful. But still I felt like, you know, life had dealt me a bad hand and like, you know, I was the most cursed human being on the planet. So like I said, there was a lot of alcohol growing up and, being an only child, all I wanted to do was fit in, and so I was around adults all the time. And so it's like I remember being three, like I remember being a kid and like not being able to wait until I was 30, you know, because I felt like if I'm an adult, then, you know, I'm going to be able to like stay up late with the people and I'm going to be able to drink this weird stuff that they're drinking that seems to make them, you know, seem so happy and have fun. And somebody is going to be legally required to sleep in a bed with me because I'll be married, and so I won't be so scared going to bed every night. So these were like my goals. I've told my husband that sometimes the only reason I keep him around. So I would make drinks for my dad. He drank Scotch on the Rocks, and I would make these big cocktails for him. And I remember like walking over to him and I would like take little sips of them and I absolutely loved it. And sometimes he would let me sit there with him on the couch and like, you know, take pus off his cigar and like he would give me a little sip of something and I just absolutely loved it. It was exactly like where I wanted to be and what I wanted to be doing. And the first time I can remember getting drunk, I was 9. I was at a wedding, and I was like the flower girl or something. And they gave me champagne, and the whole night after the limousine to the wedding, all I could think about was getting my hands on more champagne. And I just remember by the end of the night, I was like whipping around the dance floor, just like screaming bloody murder, just like having the time of my life. You know, it was like the most fun. And I remember I had to go to bed, and everybody got to stay down at the bar, and I was so pissed. You know, I was 9 years old, and I was just, like, stewing in my bed. And all I wanted to do was be down in, like, this smoke-filled bar. And I remember I had blue lights, and I just wanted to just be hanging out with everybody. And, you know, like, my parents would give me alcohol here and there like holidays and stuff, like champagne again. And even just as a little kid, I was very manipulative with how I was going to make sure I got more. So it's like I didn't want to look like that I was drinking it too fast, because if I liked it too much, maybe they wouldn't give me any more. You know, it's like candy, but maybe if I treated it like a vegetable, they would give me more. And, you know, and I would, like, side up to my parents, and they'd be like, can I, you know, and I would, like, play this game with them, you know, and the whole night would be about, like, how do I get more champagne, and this is even before I can remember getting that feeling that we get from alcohol. Like, I just was obsessed with it. Like, even before I got any of the great, you know, effects from it, I just, like, loved it, and I was obsessed with it. And so what ended up happening is, you know, I went to high school, and I remember going to my first keg party, and I didn't know how to use a keg. I'd never seen a keg. I didn't know kegs existed, but it was this big silver thing, and there was a cord and a thing, and I didn't know what I was doing. But like with everything, I'm not going to tell you that I don't know what I'm doing. You know, for all you knew, I've been drinking for the last 14 years, you know, and I got one of these in my bedroom, and I know what I'm doing. So I remember I perched outside of the keg and, like, watched people and tried to figure out what they did, and they, you know, they're pumping it, and, like, and I understood the foam. So it was, like, my goal is, like, I just got to get up there and pour the perfect cup of beer. And I did that. And so, like, for the rest of my time in high school, like, I prided myself on having the perfect pour. But, you know, I got drunk that night, and it was, like, no big deal, you know, but it's, like, it was kind of, like, one of those first times where it's, like, I was always really insecure, like, hanging out with girls and, like, being around boys, and, like, I felt like just this, like, weird, ugly duckling, and, you know, it's, like, all my friends were cool, and they'd already had boyfriends and their first kiss, and, you know, I just was, like, this awkward, like, 14-year-old, you know, I just felt like I didn't belong, and, you know, but that night, like, you know, a guy flirted with me, and I flirted back, and, like, I felt, like, totally at peace and at ease, and, like, I was having fun, and I was like, this is what it's supposed to be like. And it turns out, like, my mom and a couple of the other moms, like, were spying on the party, and so I got home the next day, and, you know, we had a long talk about drugs and alcohol, and, you know, my dad talked about, like, all these drugs that he did when he was, you know, a teenager and into his 20s, and, like, you know, I'm never supposed to do that. All I could remember thinking was, like, whatever you're talking about, I want to get my hands on that as soon as possible. And all it did was, like, entice me more to, like, you know, try to figure out how to do it. But, you know, and their conversation and their punishment did nothing. I was just like, what's happening next weekend? Where are we going? And any weekend that didn't involve drinking was, like, a waste of a weekend in my books. You know, it's like if we weren't going to a party and if we couldn't get somebody to buy us alcohol, it was just like, oh, I just have to, like, endure the next 5 days until the weekend. And I don't know if my friends felt the same way. We didn't really talk about it, but they didn't seem to mind, you know, going to movies or just, like, hanging out at somebody's house. And so what ended up happening is my parents had this very stocked liquor cabinet. And, you know, it didn't really matter where I pulled from because it was just always restocked because somebody else was drinking a lot too. So I would sit on the big kitchen counter. I would wait till my parents went to bed. So it's like I'd have to get through the whole day, and then I would just, like, wait patiently until my parents went to bed, and then, like, it felt like my day began. And, you know, I would pull from the liquor cabinet. My dad was drinking a lot of gin at the time, so I was drinking a lot of gin and Diet Coke. You know, or whatever, tequila, and I always mixed it with Diet Coke. I loved hard alcohol. I didn't like beer. Wine seemed like a waste of time, and I loved everything about hard alcohol. I loved the burn and the warmth in your mouth. I loved how it would feel going down your throat. I loved how it warmed your chest, and I loved that you could feel it, like, in your gut. And, you know, and it didn't take long for the effect to come on me, and I would sit and I would, you know, make myself some cocktails. And it's like I just felt totally at peace. And I felt like life is fun. And I would start calling people and I would start calling boys and I would stay up really late. And, like, the goal was to get just drunk enough to where I was, like, about to pass out. Because I had a lot of fear going to bed at night. I always just had these, like, fears that someone was going to break in our house and, like, murder me and kill me and do awful things to me. So I hated going to bed. So I actually used alcohol for a very long time, I think up until I got sober, to help put me to sleep because I had so much anxiety. But so I would, like, stumble back to my room and just pass out on my bed. And that was the ideal night for me. Like, that's exactly where I wanted to be, and that's all I wanted to be doing. And, you know, there weren't really any consequences in high school. You know, I'd gotten into a couple fights with some girlfriends that didn't like me drinking and driving, but you know, aside from that, you know, I had a therapist who, this is the one thing I should say. I was removed from alcohol for about 3 months. I got mono. It was the first time I started to have, like, significant panic attacks. And I wasn't able to put the connection together until way later in life. But, like, the panic attacks started. You know, I was very uncomfortable. I didn't want to leave the house. It was the first time I was ever put on, like, medication, and I had to start going to therapy and all that stuff. And all that ended right when I started drinking again, but I remained in therapy for the next 4 years. But, you know, I think I was pretty open with her about my drinking. You know, and she talked to me quite a bit about AA, and I was not interested at all, you know, like, and I was doing stuff at the time, like, I used to ride horses, and, you know, just to get down to the horse show, I would have to pick up, like, a six-pack and, like, take Xanax and, like, get down to the horse show, and, you know, like, I don't think, like, the other girls that I was riding with were doing that, you know, but I didn't think anything of it. I just thought I, like, you know, as my friend liked to tell me, he's like, you're just a good time, and so I was like, yeah, I'm just fun, and, so I went to college. I picked the school that I went to because it was close to home. There was a boy who broke up with me that went to school there, so I figured if I got back into the same town as him, maybe he'd take me back. And when I'd gone there to visit, it was just like a giant booze fest. And so I went there, and lo and behold, I slept with, I guess, roommate, so he didn't want me back. I still pined after him for a while. And I drank a lot, over guys. You know, I, like, if a guy didn't like me, you know, I would just, like, drink the pain away. You know, drink, like, oh, I'm so lonely, da-da-da. But, like, drinking solved that. Like, immediately once I would start drinking, I'd be like, he wants me back. I'm going to go over to his house. I'm going to, you know, call him 18 times. I'm going to show up at the party, you know. And alcohol gave me that, Bill talks about it in his story, that old fierce determination to win came back. And that's exactly, like, when I read that in his story, I was like, yes! You know, and that's exactly what it did. Like, on my own, without alcohol, I feel like the biggest piece, you know, and, like, I feel like nobody wants me around. I feel like I'm a big loser. I hate myself. I mean, just, like, self-loathing to extreme, really, self-centeredness. But I start drinking, and it's, like, this, like, feeling just comes from me where I'm like, yes, I can do it. They want me. I got to do this. I got to be there, da-da-da. And, you know, until I pass out, that feeling is there. And it's, like, it's a feeling that I continue to chase forever. And so the first semester of my college, I just drank my brains out. I joined a sorority, you know, thinking, like, you know, that's where the party was. But really it was, like, pantyhose and chapter meetings, and I was not into that at all. I actually didn't like women. I didn't want to be friends with women. So I dropped out of that and basically holed up in an apartment with two of my guy friends and just drank. And I was driving home one night, and I got into a car accident. There was a biker who was coming, and I swerved, and I hit, like, four parked cars along the side of the road. I'm not sure how I did it. Like, it was, like, I hit a car here, I hit a car here, I hit a car here. It was very bizarre, but broken steering rod and all, because I was able to do anything drunk. I parked my car and, you know, brought my fast food up to my dorm and, like, busted in and woke my roommate up and told her what happened. And she had, like, a normal person's reaction to the scenario. She was like, are you okay? Did you hurt anybody? Like, can we do anything? Should we call the police? And I was like, eh, no big deal, you know. And I didn't care about the damage that had been caused. I didn't care about the people who I had harmed. You know, I didn't care. You know, I just, like, wanted my food and I wanted to get to sleep. And I was going to call Grandma the next day and have her clean up the mess for me. But the police came. So I had the option. You can either go to jail or we can take you to the hospital and get your blood. And, you know, I opted for the hospital. I didn't know. I should have opted for jail. But they dropped me off at, like, four in the morning, and I called my parents. One of many inappropriate phone calls to my parents at odd hours. And, you know, I explained to them what happened, and I burst out, you know, in tears. I'm like, but I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to go to AA, and I'm so sorry. You know, because in my head, an alcoholic was, you know, somebody that drank too much, that got into trouble, but then goes to these meetings, and everybody feels sorry for them, so they get out of trouble. So I was like, done. And I started to go to meetings, and I got sober for the first time at 18 in an Alano club in Tucson, Arizona. It was in a trailer park. And, these people were, like, we were, like, miles apart. But they were the most sincere, caring, kind-hearted people. I mean, exactly what I find in every AA room that I've ever been to. And they reached out their hand, and they tried to carry a message. and they loved me, and they took care of me, and they supported me, you know. And I stayed sober there for about 7 months until I went back to home to Los Angeles. And, you know, and while I was there, like, you know, I think I had a sponsor, but, you know, she was just this woman that I was supposed to call but didn't. There were the steps, which I thought were very interesting for them. I was not interested in doing them. They talked a lot about God, and I was like, oh, that's cool. I don't do that. You know, and I just sort of, like, hung out in the fellowship. You know, I had nothing better to do. Like, nobody wanted to hang out with me at school because I, you know, was, like, the weird girl that was in AA. And, like, so I had, like, no friends. So all I had was this, like, AA group. And so I just sort of, like, hung out in the fellowship and, you know, and they kept me safe until I went home. And I tried to go to meetings when I got back to L.A., but really what happened is I started to acquire the things that I need to make myself feel better. You know, I got a boyfriend, I got a job, I got an apartment. Like, I don't have a drinking problem. I was just 18, like, no big deal. Who doesn't get a DUI in college? So I started to drink again. And, you know, they talk about, you know, our disease progresses. And, you know, where I left off, you know, I was far beyond actually where I left off. And I was a big blackout drinker. And what would happen is, you know, I lived in Los Angeles at the time, and I did a lot of driving. And I didn't have, like, at that time, a ton of people to drink with, and I loved drinking in, like, dark, dirty bars. And, like, people my age weren't into that. And so I would drive, like, out to Hollywood and just get, like, obliterated. And, you know, and I would be in these blackouts, and I would be driving home. And I would wake up in the morning, usually at that point in, like, you know, in my bed. And, you know, but, like, having no clue how I got home, having no clue, like, who I was talking to or what I had done. And, this is when that fear started for me, that, like, impending doom. And I would wake up, and, like, this panic would set in over me. And I would, like, circle my car to see if, like, something had happened, that if I had hit somebody. Because things were happening to me in blackouts that should have wakened me up. And they weren't. And so, like, I had no clue what was happening in these blackouts. You know, and I would flip through the paper to see if there were, like, reported hit and runs. And so I just constantly lived in this, like, panic and fear. And the only thing that took that away from me was drinking. You know, and so I would, like, hold my breath until about 5 o'clock, find some people to drink with, and then just do it all over again. And each day I would wake up and I'd be like, tonight's going to be different. I'm going to take a cab. Maybe I won't drink. Maybe I'll go to the gym. You know, things will be, I'm just not going to do this. And, you know, and I'd been to AA, and there is a seed that gets planted when you come in that you can never shake once you've been here. And so, you know, I continued to do that. And really what ended up happening is, like, from 20 to about 28, I would bounce in and out of AA every, like, 2 years or so. And I would go on these runs for, you know, a year to 3 years, depending on the phase. And, you know, and the drinking would progress. You know, I got sober again, and, you know, and the same thing happened. You know, I started going to meetings again in Los Angeles. I got a sponsor. She was a lovely woman. She tried her best to help me. You know, I went to meetings. I even got, this is the new thing, I got service positions. And, but again, like, I was not interested in the program that was outlined in this book. I was trying to figure out how to fit AA into my life. You know, like, I had a job, I had this boyfriend, you know, it's like I was very busy, you know, I had to go to the gym, I had to do all this stuff, and, like, if I can get to a meeting, that's great. And I would go to meetings, and, you know, I would absolutely relate to the speakers, and I would relate to people sharing, and I would share. God, who knows what I was talking about? But, and I would share. And, you know, but, like, the steps were just, like, not of interest to me. And so, you know, for me, unless I replace the solution of alcohol with the solution outlined in this book, I continue to drink. And what ended up happening, I just lost my train of thought. So I had this boyfriend. You know, everything else was a higher power to me, but besides AA, everything else, when I wasn't drinking. And he was my higher power. You know, we were in a long 6-year relationship, and he didn't like AA. You know, and he would talk about the guys in AA, he told me it was a cult and all this stuff, and so, you know, I slowly stopped, you know, going to meetings, because it's like, well, I don't want to lose him, but he didn't want me drinking, so it was like this very strange, you know, like, tightrope wire I had to walk. So what I did was I just hid my drinking from him. I started to drink again very slowly. I started to take straws of people's, because I was hanging out in bars. I was going to parties. I was hanging out in bars. I was going out to happy hours with coworkers and all this stuff. And I would take a straw and I would just like, I'm just going to taste it. And I would pop it in my mouth. And, you know, and over time that turns into, you know, calling Pink Dot at 11:30 at night to order a fifth of vodka, peanut butter, milk, and mustard, because I'm obviously doing other things besides drinking. And I started, you know, a long couple years of very, very isolated binge drinking. And, you know, on the nights that I wouldn't see him, you know, I would get down a fifth or two and just sit in my apartment and drink. And I loved it. Like, I loved drinking. I loved drinking alone. I loved drinking with people. It didn't matter. But I would sit on my couch and I would, like, watch the Golden Girls and I would talk to my cat and I would cry in the mirror and I would just drink my face off. And sometimes I would wake up in bed. Sometimes I would wake up on the couch. Sometimes I would wake up, like, face first on the floor. I don't know. And then, like, I would go through my phone to make sure, like, I hadn't called anybody. I hadn't gone anywhere because, you know, I was keeping this a secret from my family, my friends, my boyfriend. Everybody thought I was still sober. And eventually, like, I was madly in love with him, but he was getting in the way of my drinking, and we had one fight, and, like, he didn't call me for, like, a week, so I decided that, you know, we were going to break up, and I went to Vegas, and I went there for a conference and met a guy who, very hips-looking cool and was drinking a lot, and I drank in front of him, and I was like, this is what I need. I need a guy that I can drink with. And so I broke up with that guy and immediately jumped in a relationship with this guy, and my drinking just, like, took off. We were talking in the car about Pedialyte, and I was introduced to Pedialyte at the time, which is the most fantastic hangover remedy everywhere, anywhere, like, at all, and it just, like, propelled my drinking. But this is when I started drinking in the morning. I started drinking at work. I was on the radio at the time, and I thought alcohol made me better at my job. So I would be on the radio just, like, plastered. And, you know, and it was a fun summer. And, you know, it was everything that I thought I wanted. You know, it's like, you know, I was flying back and forth to D.C. from L.A., and I could drink as much as I want. And, like, I felt like I had been cooped up for so long with this guy and cooped up for so long drinking by myself. Like, to be free, you know, was amazing. And, you know, eventually, you know, you hit a bottom. And, you know, when I woke up one night, I worked from 3 to 6 a.m., so I had a very strange schedule, and I woke up one night, and, like, my face was all jacked up, and my knees were all screwed up, and, you know, and I had been alone in my apartment for, you know, 10 hours just drinking, and I wasn't sure what had happened, because I wasn't, like, fully dressed, like, it was weird, and, like, none of the bottles were in the apartment anymore, so, like, I don't know where I had gone doing it. And it just scared me. Probably nothing happened, but so much had happened in blackouts that any time I woke up from one, like the imagination does wonders. And, you know, my friend was on my couch. She was staying with me, and she just looked at me, and I said, I need help. She's like, yeah, you do. And I went to my first detox. My dad described it as a place where they put you in a bed, and they pump you full of fluids and a lot of drugs, and I was like, this is awesome. And so I went there. I love psych wards. I love rehabs. I love them all. Because you're totally unaccountable. They tell you when to wake up. They tell you when to eat. They tell you when to go to bed. They give you a lot of drugs. It's awesome. It wasn't great for my sobriety, but so I got sober again, and the same thing happened. And I was going to meetings, and you know, I had a sponsor again, and I just was so resistant to what was outlined in here. I remember my sponsor. We had gone through, like, you know, I think I'd done a fifth step with him, and you know. He suggested I raise my hand and make myself available for sponsorship. And I looked at him dead in the face, and I said, I'm not interested in helping anybody at all. And he was like, okay. And he didn't push me. And you know, like, you know, I might have been sober. I might have been going to meetings. I might have been doing a little more than I was doing in the past. But, like, I was still real uncomfortable because I wasn't doing this. And my bright idea was to move to Washington, D.C. because I needed to get away from the ex-boyfriend. They weren't treating me right at work. I wanted to drink, and I couldn't keep it a secret anymore, so I needed to get 3,000 miles away. I was going to move to D.C. I was going to be able to drink. I was going to be able to have the normal life that I always wanted to, because that desire to drink like a normal person always stuck with me. I just thought, like, if I just put the puzzle pieces together in the right way, then I wouldn't drink the way that I had been drinking, because I drank because of him. You know, I drank because, you know, my boss was not nice to me. You know, I drank because I didn't have enough money. I drank because my apartment didn't look right. You know, I drank for all these reasons. Like, I drank because of my dad. I drank because of my mom. You know, it was all your fault. You know, because what I was a nice girl that just drank a little too much, you know, and fall on my sword for you all that I can, and I sacrifice for you. And I mean, I just had a really warped perception of who I was. And I moved to D.C., and I was to have one of the most pathetic years of my entire life. You know, I started drinking immediately. I think I went to one meeting, and, like, all the people were old, and I was like, this is a sign. This is a sign. And I started drinking, and this is when I started to become really physically addicted, you know. And, you know, so I would have to wake up in the morning. So I would go out. So this would be a typical weekend, let's say. Weekends were more fun. I'd go out with my friends. I would then, you know, I would either have to sneak back home because I was getting, like, people weren't drinking enough and I wanted to go home and, like, drink in my private isolation so I could, like, drink like I wanted to. Or I would go out and then I would, like, in a blackout find myself, like, taking the metro home and, like, coming to in a Chinese food restaurant with, like, some woman trying to give me food. And I have no clue how that happened. But most of the nights were me on my couch, again, with my cat, listening to some very pathetic, sad music on repeat, crying to myself in the mirror. That was my night. And, you know, that was the brilliant life that I had, you know, sought out for myself. And you know what, though? I was happy. I was happy in that moment when I was drinking. I didn't care if I was crying. I felt totally at peace. And I would wake up in the morning, and that feeling would come on me. And, you know, and I wanted to go back to AA, but AA didn't work. You know, I wanted to not drink that day, but I didn't know how. And I wanted to call somebody and ask for help, but I was too ashamed. I was too prideful. And, you know, so what would happen is I'd make myself a promise, and I'd get out of my bed. I just wasn't going to drink in the morning. You know, let's just see if I can get to work. And I would get out, and I would feel sick, and I would look in the mirror, and I would be shaking, and I would have to go drink. And what would happen is, you know, I would pull from that bottle in my freezer, and everything changes for me. Like, life is great. I can't wait to go to work. I'm gonna just nail it in this meeting. I'm absolutely gonna like email that guy who's been telling me for 7 months to stop calling him. Like, he's changed his mind overnight. You know, all these things, you know, and like I felt beautiful, I felt smart, all these things. And you know, and I would go to work and, you know, I'd be in meetings and my shakes would be really bad and like I'd have to like dart out to a liquor store and then like go drink in some public bathroom and like come back. You know, and that was like my life. And it was just getting out of control. And so, you know, what ended up happening was I asked a friend to take me to a meeting. He knew that I was struggling. And he dropped me off at a meeting in Georgetown, and I walked in, and it was like five guys and maybe like a girl. And I sat down, and I don't remember sharing, but the guys, I still know them today, you know, they said, you just sounded really angry and crazy. And what they did was... you know, they asked me if I needed help, and they're like, do you need to hang out tonight? And they took me to Johnny Rockets, like, down the street, and they just sat and they listened to me, like, wail on forever. I mean, I couldn't have been more obnoxious, I'm sure. you know, they're members of my home group, and I remember one of the guys walked outside with me to smoke a cigarette, and he asked for my number, and I was like, yes. And he was like, this is not for me. He's like, I think I have a woman that will be able to help you. And I was like, oh. And the woman actually she's my sponsor today. And the guy that asked for my number is my husband today. It's really weird. So I joke that God really knew how to get my attention. We didn't start dating right then. But anyways, so I met her at a meeting, and you know, I ended up going to rehab for 3 months after that, but she kept in touch with me for those 3 months. She would text me, and she was just available when I needed it. And, you know, the rehab was a great phase to dry out, but what ended up happening is I came home, and armed with all this AA experience that I've had for the last 10 years, I proceeded to try to tell my sponsor how to sponsor me. And, like, any suggestion that she had, I was like, that's interesting for you, but I don't think I'm going to do that. And I would wink at her, and I was, like, really belligerent, and, like, I just wasn't interested in doing what she was doing. But this group of women that I fell into was just really, really active and really into service and really, I mean, like, very active in our home group and going to conferences and all this stuff. And they just kind of, I had nothing better to do, and they just kind of linked up with me, and I found myself in the middle of AA. So, but I still wasn't doing anything, so I ended up drinking again, and I remember talking to her the next day, and she said, you can either do what we do and get what we get, or she's like, you can keep trying it your way, and, you know, God bless you, you know, whatever you need. And there was enough desperation in that moment and enough willingness, like, in that perfect magical moment where I was like, okay, fine. And, you know, and I remember one of my best friends today, she's like, before that happened, she's like, you were such, you know, a bee. Basically, she's like, you were awful. And my attitude didn't necessarily, like, my attitude changed, but my belief in the process didn't change. And it didn't matter, actually. Like, I didn't believe anything that these people were telling me. Like, why do I got to go to a meeting every night? Like, why do I have to be there a half an hour before? Why do I have to call women? Like, why do I have to do this? Why do I have to get service positions? I don't want to do this. But I threw a smile on my face and just started saying yes. My friend Melissa called me New Attitude Jill. And I just owned it. I was like, whatever I got to do. And the thing that saved me at the beginning were sober plans. I didn't have a car at the time, and all I wanted to do was, like, metro to the meeting and show up, like, 5 minutes before and get home, or maybe go to a meeting right by my house, you know, and so I can go home and, like, get to bed early, all this stuff. But my sponsor was, like, adamant on me making sober plans. So I'd make these plans, and people in AA, they show up. So, you know, it'd be Tuesday, and I'd be like, maybe Esther canceled. And, of course, she didn't. And so I had these plans every single night when, like, my coworkers going to happy hours, you know, or, like, somebody, like, wanted to go to dinner with me. Like, I didn't have an option. And my pride was kind of, like, a saving grace for me at the beginning because I just wanted you to like me. So I showed up. I was so embarrassed about drinking again. Like, I didn't want to be that person because at the time I saw my home group as this, like, perfect entity of, like, nobody had troubles. And I mean, I understand now that we're all very sick alcoholics and I've heard everybody's story. But, like, everybody just seemed so happy and shiny. I was like, they don't have the same problems that I do. And I just wanted them to like me. So I would show up and say yes. And if anybody asked me to do something, I was, like, the first to raise my hand. And so, you know, my pride sort of got the better of me, and thank God, because I was thrown right into the middle of AA. You know, I got service positions at my home group and, like, nearly every other meeting that I went to. You know, I started to do the steps with my sponsor, you know, and I struggled with the honesty part with my sponsor for a long time. You know, she was a god to me. You know, I struggled to find a higher power, so I was very, you know, I didn't want to tell her the truth about things that I was feeling and, you know, things that I thought and maybe things that I did. And so I was keeping secrets, some really icky secrets. And, you know, we went through the steps and we went through 4 and 5 and I got honest about some of the stuff, but not all of the stuff. And, you know, but I was in a pretty good place, but I was still really uncomfortable. And, you know, and I didn't understand why the obsession to drink seemed to go away so quickly for everybody else. And it didn't go away for me, but I didn't talk about it. And, you know, but I just kind of kept putting one foot in front of the other. And what ended up happening was, you know, I celebrated a year and all was good, you know. And I would look great at a meeting, so I thought. You know, I would look great in front of my sponsor. You know, I would look great in front of, like, the girls that I was sponsoring. You know, I'd keep up this perfect face for AA, you know, but all the while, like, I was keeping a big secret and, you know, I was acting out at work and, you know, I was being, you know, an a-hole to my boyfriend at the time, and, you know, just things were not good behind the scenes, but, like, I wasn't going to be honest, because I didn't want to look bad. And, you know, what happened was I'd gone home to Los Angeles a couple times, and I'd taken some medication for an issue that I don't have, and, you know, the pill wasn't prescribed to me, and, you know, and I kept it a secret, and it was Ambien. I don't have sleeping issues. You know, I celebrated a second year, dishonest year, and every day I would think about it. And, you know, I would hear, like, you know, I think they'd say honesty about, like, 8 times and how it works, and people would read it at meetings, and I'd be like, oh, please stop. You know, and my plan was, I'm just going to hold on to this until I get to 5 years. And then, as I have five, so nobody's going to really notice that I've backtracked to four. You know, it's not going to be a big deal. And I lived with this, and it ate me up. Like, there was no growth for that year and a half at all. And my, you know, but I was doing, the only reason I think I did not drink was because I was doing everything else. You know, I was talking to my sponsor every day. You know, we were still going through the steps. You know, I was still sponsoring people. I still had a lot of service. Like, I was right in the middle. But I was, like, freaking out inside. And, you know, people would talk about changing their sobriety date at the podium, and I'd be like, no! You know, and then, you know, I wouldn't think about it for, like, 2 months. You know, and I'd be like, see, I got this. No problem. And, you know, so there's no God getting into my life at that point because, you know, I'm still running the show. I'm controlling everything. And, you know, and my sponsor would keep talking to me about prayer and meditation and, like, you need to find a God and da-da-da, but my head was so loud, like, I couldn't do it. And, you know, and she would ask me, you know, because just things weren't right. For the amount of stuff that I was doing, I was still acting real sick. You know, and she would ask me probably, like, once a month or so, she'd be like, anything you're holding on to? I'd be like, no. And, you know, she'd ask me again, and I just used to be so mad at her for asking. And so I would, like, spit out little things, you know, like, oh, yeah, it's cheated on. You know, I did something. I can't even remember the stupid lies that I made up. But, you know, and I would sort of, like, spit these out. And what happened was I wanted to drink. You know, I was engaged at the time to the guy that asked for my phone number. And everything looked amazing on the outside, you know, like things were going well at work, you know, I was engaged to this wonderful man, like, you know, I had this lovely apartment, I had all the stuff that I needed, and I had these, like, fantasies about, like, getting into a car accident, you know, and, like, you know, so much to the point where I'd be, like, disabled for a little while and have to be, like, loaded up on pain medicine. You know, I was like, you know, like, if I can get into an accident, they'll shoot me up with the lotta, it'll be great, and then I'll have to drink. You know, I was just, like, my imagination was running wild. You know, and then I was like, if Brendan would just, like, be meaner to me or be a bigger a-hole, like, I could leave him. And then if I leave him, then I can leave this group, and then I can leave my sponsor, and then I can leave D.C., and I can move back to L.A. or move back to a small town and just set up my new perfect life. And, you know, the perfect life always involves me sitting in front of the TV drinking a fifth. That's all I wanted to do. And I remember I was sitting at work one day, and, like, I had another really terrible conversation with my sponsor, you know, and she asked me, she's like, again, like, she's like, are you holding on to something? And I was like, no. And, you know, I sat at my desk, and it was this moment, and I really do believe, like, this is when, you know, I fully just accepted to have a third step and have God in my life. And, you know, I sat at my desk, and I shot her a text, and I said, I think we need to meet for coffee. And she was like, okay, as you knew. And, you know, we sat down for coffee, and I got honest about, you know, what I had done and what my real sobriety date was and all this stuff. And, like, this feeling just, like, totally came over me. Like, I just opened wide up, you know, and, like, everything was able to get in at that point. And it really had a profound impact on my sobriety. So, you know, I beg of you, if you're holding on to anything, there's nothing that I've been judged for here. There's nothing that has been too bad or too shameful or too weird that anybody has, like, turned their back on me and said, no, you can't come back, or, you know, or I haven't been pointed in the direction where somebody's like, I did it too, and this is how I got through it. There's nothing that I have done here, and I'm sure there's nothing that anybody that can do, you know, to kick you out this door. And, you know, I just regret holding on to it for as long as I did. And, really anything that I've held on to as long as I have. And, you know, and what that did for me is it really allowed me to start developing a relationship with God. You know, I was able to begin praying. You know, I lied for a really long time about the prayer and meditation. You know, my sponsor would be like, did you pray? I was like, absolutely. You know, and we would go on these trips, and I would bring my books and stuff as if, like, I had been meditating every day. And we would sit down, and I'd just try to see what people did. And then I was like, oh, yeah, that's how I do it, too. And, you know, the only time I ever meditated or prayed was when I was with my sponsor because she was doing it. And, you know, but I was able to start engaging in that practice, and it really sort of it changed everything. And, you know, but I got to a point, you know, I struggled, like I said, with sponsorship a little bit and making my sponsor my higher power. And I remember, you know, I got to a point, we had a very long conversation, and she just sort of had to, she just had to talk me through it. And she related to my experience. She told me about her experience in that. And she said, you know, I am not your God. I am a channel. That's all I am. Like, you need to get that through your head. And I made a deal at that point with myself and God. And I said, all right, you know, if this is it, I'm just going to. And I, every time I call my sponsor, I say, God, you know, please let me hear you through her. And, you know, things have been amazingly different from that day on. There is nothing that is between her and I, and it's a very, very special sacred relationship for me. I said it the other night, and I kind of laughed at myself, but I believe it. Like, I thought to myself, if somebody questions me about this, will I stick to this? And yes, I do believe it's a divinely inspired relationship. I absolutely believe that I was in the exact right place and moment for, you know, for Brendan to ask for my number, for him to give it to her, and for her to help me. It has been a relationship that I have never experienced before, and the help that has come from that relationship and the change and, you know, the path that she has brought me on has been, I mean, nothing that I've experienced. And I know it's not her. I know her story. I know all about her. Like, she's not God. She's a wonderful, wonderful, amazing person who has carried the message, who's been, I mean, of service beyond what anybody should be, and has really helped me develop a relationship with a loving higher power. And, you know, and that ability to be open and honest in that relationship on a daily basis has helped me with all the steps, you know, 6 and 7 especially. You know, because I, after doing my 5th step, like, I was like, yeah, like, I guess I'm manipulative. I guess I'm, you know, a scorekeeper. I guess I'm vindictive. I guess I'm dishonest. I guess I'm a big fat liar. But that's that person that was drinking, you know. But I'm like this newly evolved spiritual person. Like, what's that mean anymore? Not the case. You know, and being, and maintaining an open, honest conversation with my friends and with my sponsor and in meetings, I'm able to basically dump, you know, my inventory and my defects onto, you know, the people around me, and I'm able to hear a message as a result. Like, I'm not hearing a message if I'm not being honest about where I'm at. You know, so that's really been a huge help in 6 and 7, because the more honest I am, the more help I get, you know, the more solution-focused, you know, suggestions that I get. And I'm able to not just act as if, but take a different action. And it's been incredibly helpful in my marriage, at work, with my family. You know, I did 8 and 9. You know, I've had some really tremendous experiences with the amends process. You know, I've made amends to both of my parents. My mom is one of the most amazing women in the entire world. She is the nicest, sweetest, kindest, most loving human being, and I was brutal to her. I mean, just abusive. It was terrible. You know, and I mean, it was sickening. It was the first time I cried was when I read my 8-step inventory to my sponsor about my mom. I didn't even cry on my 4th and 5th step, like, oh, whatever. But when I really saw on paper what I had done to my mother, it was horrifying. And, you know, through me working my program and her working her program, she's a proud Al-Anon, you know, and through the amends process, and not just the formal amends, but really the living amends. The living amends have been a huge, huge part of building that relationship back with both my parents. But especially with my mom, she is my best friend today. Like, I can't imagine not talking to her, you know, every other day and telling her everything about my life and giving her counsel on things. And, I mean, it is one of the most amazing relationships I have. And to think that I threw away years, you know, and did stuff to this woman, it's just, it breaks my heart. You know, my father, I called him in a blackout and told him I was going to commit suicide when I was in D.C., and I wreaked havoc on that relationship. And, you know, I created fear in their lives, like unnecessary fear and panic. And, you know, and today, you know, today they know everything that's going on in my life. They absolutely love my sponsorship family. They love my home group. They love hearing about everything that I do in AA. I mean, they think of it as like their second family as well. And, you know, to be able to know that, you know, they go to bed with a peace that I was never able to give them, you know, but it's absolutely been given through, you know, through a relationship, the relationships I've developed here, you know, and, you know, I've made some great amends with my friends, you know, two of my friends who, the relationships were pretty, I mean, I did a lot of damage, you know, but I have these girlfriends that just, like, never gave up on me, you know. So it's like the relationships that I caused all this harm in were still very, you know, alive and well, you know, when I got sober. But there was a lot of making up to do. And, you know, I really do believe it's a gift from God, you know, that two of them asked me to be the godparent of their child, because I'm the only person in their life they can think that has a spiritual connection. And I was like, that's weird, you know, but I mean, it's true. I mean, I do, I believe in God. I believe, you know, we all have a path and I try my best to live by that. And, you know, there's no way those girls would have asked me to do that years ago. There's absolutely no way. And so I get to show up in both of those boys' life, you know, in a very special and unique way. And, you know, 10, 11, and 12, I take a daily inventory, talk to my sponsor every day or every other day. And like I said, I really try to be honest. Like, if there's something that happened through the day where I'm like, I don't need to tell her that, you know, that's like the first thing that goes on my list. And I really try to think through my day. You know, where was I selfish, dishonest, resentful, afraid? You know, do I own amends, all that. And, you know, I really try to think not so much about, like, what happens, like, moment by moment, but like, what's the broader issue that's happening here? You know, it's like there's something going on, you know, because there's usually patterns. Like, nothing in my life is compartmentalized. You know, so if I'm acting out at work, like, what's happening at home? What's happening with my sponsor? What's happening with my family? And she, taking an honest look at that and just giving it over, and I do really believe I'm giving it over to God in those conversations, I'm able to remain open for a solution. And I do think, you know, that has been a huge part of the growth that I've been able to have in the last year. I've struggled a little bit. There's just been some stuff going on, and I've struggled with prayer and meditation recently. And, you know, instead of holding it in and, you know, being super dishonest about it, you know, I actually got to get on the phone with my sponsor and be like, I'm struggling, you know, and she pointed me to that spot in, you know, the 11th step, you know, and where it talks about, like, we all have points in our time where it's hard for us to pray. And, you know, it's like I said, like, there's nothing that I do feel, you know, think that, like, they didn't already figure out an answer for in here, you know, but it's like, I got to get my pride out of the way and be able to talk about it. And, you know, and so she gave me some, you know, some good meditations to try and some different things. And, you know, and I took the action, and, you know, it's been helpful. And, you know, in 12, like, you know, the person that, you know, looked her sponsor dead in the eye and said, I don't want to help anybody, like, I get the most today, and I still, it sounds weird coming out of my mouth even, I get the most today when I'm being of service to people. You know, whether it's through sponsorship, whether it's, like, coffee at a meeting, whether it's, you know, I have the privilege of, you know, doing service work at the district level, and I love it. I love going to area assemblies. I love all of that. I usually cry when I leave an area assembly because I'm so grateful. I don't know why, but I just love it. There's something about being in a room full of, like, a couple hundred alcoholics who are so incredibly passionate about AA and, like, the real, like, nuts and bolts, nitty-gritty, that it's, like, it's such a special experience. I suggest to anybody to get involved with it. I didn't think it was something that I liked, but I absolutely love it. But, you know, I used to sponsor this girl that lived in Manassas, which is, like, 45 minutes away from where I live. And I remember, like, nights when I would have to drive her home. Like, don't get me wrong, the idea of being of service to people, I still struggle with. Like, what I want to do is I want to wake up late, and then I want to lay in bed all day, maybe watch some Criminal Minds, maybe get some Chinese food, doze in and out, and not show up for anything. That's what I want to do. That is my go-to perfect day. I'm always wishing for the flu. And I never get it. It's like the most healthy immune system. Thank you. And but I remember thinking, like, oh, I have to drive Noel home. I don't want to do it. And, you know, but I do it. Like, if I say I'm going to do it and I say I'm going to be somewhere and I say yes, I show up. It's what I've been taught. I'm like a little service robot. And, but, like, my head is not, you know, my heart and my head haven't connected so much there yet. But I would drive her all the way to Manassas, and it would be the best car ride, you know. Like, she would hate it because I'd just be trying to talk to her about stuff, you know. But our relationship developed, you know. Like, you know, I learned stuff about her. She learned stuff about me. And every time I would drop her off, like, I would give her this big hug, and I would just be so grateful, you know, that she was in my life and that we had this relationship. And I would drive home, and I'd usually be in tears. You know, not like sad tears, like happy tears. I just get so overwhelmed with gratitude and this feeling of peace and ease. Like, everything that I was always searching for in drinking, I just wanted to feel like I was supposed to be there, you know? Like, I always felt like I was an imposter and that, like, I'd snuck an invite or you didn't want me and I had to do things right in order to let, you know, for you to let me stay. And there's something about showing up the way it's, you know, laid out in our steps and being of service to people that gives me that feeling, you know, whether it's sponsorship and all that. And I absolutely love it. You know, I grumble, like, if I have to get up at 8 and go somewhere. But every time on the back end, I'm like, oh, I'm so glad I did that, you know, and it's just wonderful. You know, I have a great life today. You know, there's bumps and there's issues and, you know, there's all that stuff. You know, I'm not a perfect sponsee. I'm definitely not a perfect worker. I'm not a perfect wife. I'm not a perfect anything. You know, there's a lot that I do that, you know, still needs to be changed and worked on. But, you know, I really believe that if I keep maintaining that open, honest connection with my sponsor and with God and through my friends and in meetings, that I will be provided with the answers and the solutions that I need to hear. You know, and every day I get to clean up a little bit more of that mess. You know, like every day I get to take a different action. Every day I get to practice some, you know, kindness in a different way. Whereas in the past, like, I'm a runner, you know, and I've gone through some periods this year where, again, like, I wanted to pick up and just bolt. And you know, you just pick up the phone and call your sponsor. And it's amazing how, like, the things that are making you feel so crazy aren't that big of a deal. And, like, the solutions and the ideas to get you out of yourself are not that complicated. And I'm forever grateful for my sobriety. I'm forever grateful, you know, for my sponsor and my wonderful home group and the women that are in my life and who picked me up and have carried me for this long. And, you know, I wouldn't give it away for anything. But I know, I mean, I have a lot of history to show me that if I am not keeping busy, if I'm not in the middle, and I don't know exactly what works, so I try to do a little bit or a lot of everything, I know I will drink. I have no doubt that I am a sick alcoholic that will pick up in a moment's notice if I don't put something between me and that drink. And, you know, I've been thinking about it a lot lately, like talking to some of the girls I sponsor, or talking to new people. It's like I constantly have to throw something in, it's just the way I have to think about it. It's like throw it in front of the drink. You know, maybe it's like, you know, show up at a meeting, like call a new girl, do anything, just throw it in the middle, you know. And, you know, for me, it's like God. You know, I got to throw God in front of it. And, you know, as long as God stays in between me and whatever it is, like, I know I'm going to be okay. But, you know, if I let that go, like, I know I'm in trouble. So again, thank you so much for allowing me to come out, and it's been a real pleasure, and thank you for letting me share.